Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
You probably know our next guest as one of the dragons on the CBC show Dragon's Den. What you may not know is that there is a remarkable story behind his current success on Bay Street, a story that starts with unimaginable poverty. He's told his story in a memoir entitled No Bootstraps When You're Barefoot, My Rise from a Jamaican Plantation Shack to the Boardrooms of Bay Street. And with that, we welcome Wes Hall to our studio. It's great to see you.
Steve, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Tell me something. Do you think I could rock that pink suit as well as you? What do you think?
Well, you know, there's only probably about two or three people in the world that can do this.
No kidding.
And
no
if you're
kidding.
One of them, I want to join you, my friend.
Let me give you a little secret. I'm not. Yeah, I'm really not. And at some point, Sheldon, you got to get a shot of these shoes because those are, I have not quite seen shoes like that before. And I think our viewers might want to see what they look like. And they look dangerous, Wes. That's all I can say is they look dangerous.
Let's just say this. Don't get me upset when I'm wearing these shoes.
No kidding. I want to start telling your story here because it's shocking. It's shocking where you started compared to where you have ended up now. So let's go back. Your mom is 28 years old.
Yeah.
She's got seven kids. And she abandons all of you.
Yes.
You're 18 months old. How did you do it?
Well, that's the thing when you're 18 months, I had no choice. You know, she just, she boiled a pot of porridge and she left it. And she, my sister was four years old. So she must have told her that, by the way, when the kids are hungry, feed them. And my brother was 6 months old. So there we are, three of us in that house, the rest of the kids with my grandmother. And she never came back. And so as an 18-month-old kid, I'm hungry. And so Ian and I started to cry, like really loudly. And my sister Joan, again, only 4 years old, didn't know what to do because the pot was empty. And a neighbor came by and heard the commotion, came in, walked to the threshold of the house, because it's a one-bedroom place, you can see what's inside.
In rural Jamaica,
and realized that these kids were by themselves in this place.
Your father was not there?
My father was not there. My father left when I was one to come to Canada. And he was a 24-year-old man, and he'd go, I want to discover the world, and you know, Golden Grove, Jamaica wasn't big enough for me. He had ambitions of his own, and he left. So I was 1 year old, and I stayed with my mother. And as you mentioned, my mother had multiple children, and we were the last of the lot at the time. She had two other kids since then, so she had a total of nine kids.
Your grandmother saved the day, though.
My grandmother was amazing. So when that man came, the man was going by on a bicycle and heard, and he stopped and came by, and he goes, okay, I'm going to go get your grandmother. And he took off on his bicycle, and the story's been told to me, and it's passed down. He took off on his bicycle, went to the plantation, and he got my grandmother. And my grandmother came with my older sister, Barbara, and a trolley, and loaded us up and took us to the plantation house that she was raising the rest of the kids, the grandkids.
Now, your mother would drop into your life from time to time in future years.
Yeah.
Why is it that your grandmother never read your mother the Riot Act about taking care of her own children?
My grandmother kind of did, but didn't. Because, so my grandmother would, you know, she would say, listen, you need to take care of your own responsibility, right? So my mother would stop coming to see us. And so she didn't really want to go too hard on her because then she would just never come at all. And so she would, you know, you need to look after your kids, you need to, but then she would just pull back. And even with that, my mother would only show up literally to see us for like about 10 or 15 minutes.
Until the day when she finally showed up and said, Wes,
yeah,
you're coming with me.
You're anointed. You know, you are anointed to come to live with me.
Now, what precipitated that?
I didn't know at the time. I didn't know at the time, but...
And you're how old when this happened?
11. So everybody was saying, take one of the girls. The boy will look after himself. He's going to work on the plantation. He's going to be fine. But your girls are going to get pregnant, and you need to protect them. So take one of the girls. And she wouldn't have any of it. She would go, nope, I want Wes. I want Wes. And I thought I won the lottery.
You didn't, Wes.
I did not win the lottery.
Wes, she beat you. She humiliated you. She was a misery to you.
Yeah.
Why? Did you ever get to the bottom of why?
You know, I'd never understood it. And later on, I start to think, why would someone behave this way? Someone who should love you unconditionally, who actually hated you by the way they treated you. And then I start to think about how much love she had for my father. My father was the one who got away. She had all these men that came into her life, impregnated her, and then they would leave. But my dad was this man that was special. He was athletic. He was young. He was good looking. And she had him. And all the girls in the neighborhood wanted that man. And she had him. But he didn't want her.
She cracked your head open once.
She did. I still have the scar in the back of my head.
Why didn't you run away after that?
You know, it's funny because I ran away shortly before. Shortly before that happened, I literally couldn't take it anymore. And it's got to be I was about maybe 12 years old. And I ran away back to St. Thomas with my grandmother. And that was an experience. And it's almost like you're held hostage, and then you try to escape, and then you're caught. There are consequences when you try to escape and you get caught. Well, that's what happened, because after I ran away, my mother came to get me, and there were consequences after. So it was an unwritten rule after that don't even try this again.
Well, here's something she said to you. She looked at you and she said, you're black, you're ugly, and you're not mine. Now, that is a terrible thing for any mother to say to anybody.
For anyone to say to anybody at all.
Right, right.
Right.
Have you forgiven your mother for all of this over the years?
Oh, absolutely. I have, because there's no reason why you should harbor resentment. My grandmother taught me that. My grandmother wasn't resentful to any of her kids for leaving all their kids with her to look after on a plantation worker salary. She never a day was resentful, nor did she resent us as a result. So she epitomizes forgiveness. So to me, I wanted to be like her.
And you really did it.
And I did. I did. I wanted to. My grandmother had 4 children, all with the same man. And when that man became an alcoholic, she kicked him out of the house, because she go, I don't want you to corrupt my kids, my grandkids. She kicked him out. He would show up every now and then and hang out with us and so on, but she would have nothing to do with him at all. And she looked after those 4 kids on her own. And then they became adults. But one of those kids was special needs, my aunt Daphne. And she looked after her until the day she died at 97 years old. My grandmother died at 97.
Amazing.
She was committed. And so she wasn't promiscuous. She didn't abuse us. So I spent almost 11 years watching that behavior. And that informed the person that I would become later on in life.
You figured out right from wrong by watching
your grandmother. I figured it out really quickly. I figured out how to behave. She never treated us poorly. She never let us feel as if we're a burden, you know, to her. Mm. But yet, when I went to live with my mom, I was a burden. I was clearly a burden, but I couldn't understand why she would want to keep me around until I found out later on was my dad who was in Canada that she was pining for all this time, saying, where's Wes? Wes is still at the grandmother's. You need to go get him, and he needs to be with you.
Well, eventually, 1985, you do come to Canada to be with your father.
Yeah.
And to meet a bunch of siblings that you didn't really know at all.
Didn't know.
How did that transition go from Jamaica to Toronto?
Well, it was interesting because when I was in Jamaica, I was my mom kicked me out at 13. So that's when all the abuse and the beating stopped. And it was the happiest day of my life, by the way, because even though I was only 13 years old and I didn't know where I was going to live, I knew that I wouldn't be subjected to all the things that she was subjecting me to before, the physical and mental abuse that she was putting me through. And at 16, keep it living on your own, in 13 to 16, and then 16 years old, my dad goes, hey, I want you to come live with me. And I thought I won the lottery for sure this time. This time, this is the real lottery that I won. It's not a fake lottery like going to live with my mom. This was the deal because I get to go to Canada. It wasn't that I get to go to live with my dad this time. Before it was, I get to go live with my mother. This time, I get to go to Canada. And that was the golden ticket for me.
This is 37 years ago now.
This is 37 years
ago. And you show up with that accent.
I did.
What did people think of that?
Well, everybody, I said, well, what can't understand him. I said, they couldn't. So I went to, so September 27, 1985, I came here on a Friday. And on Monday, I was in school. And as you know, when you go to school, before you get to your classes, you meet with a guidance counselor, and they pick your subjects for you. They put me in the ESL program. English as a second language.
And to be clear, it was your first language.
It was my first language.
But it sounded different from everybody else.
It had a little accent on it that the guidance counselor goes, I don't know what this guy can, I can't understand this kid.
Well, in fact, there's an expression you use in the book, and you'll say it better than I will, because I never heard it before. Bus me cock?
Bus me cock.
What is that?
So this is an instrument, a weapon that my dad had. Where if you, it's made of leather, and it's usually salted and soaked to make it really firm and thick. And that's something that he uses to administer discipline when we're out of line.
So he hit you with
it. As children, yes, as a young man, as a young man. And the expression, I think, came from, well, if you think you're a man, I'm going to use this to let you know that you're not a man anymore. And so the bus macaque is a thing that Jamaican, you know, parents use to discipline their children, and it should be outlawed, quite frankly. Yeah. It should be.
Okay, you get a bunch of jobs once you're done school and you're in Toronto. You get a job at a chicken factory. Eventually, you move up to a mailroom at a law firm, which is a pretty good job, Stikeman Elliott,
yeah.
One of the big law firms in town. And at some point, somebody says, you'll never become a clerk here at the law firm. Mm-hmm. What did you infer when they said that to you?
I looked around the department, and all I saw were women in the department. There were no guys in the department. So I figured they just don't hire men to be law clerks in this company. The guys are lawyers, because it's all mostly men were lawyers at the time, mm-hmm. and women were law clerks. And so I got that as a message that you're not going to be a law clerk here because you're a man.
So actually, you didn't infer it's the color of my skin that's a problem.
I did not infer racism. Hmm. But here's the difference in my case. And I didn't start to really put my finger on racism until way into my career. See, when I was in Jamaica, I saw black school teachers, black principals, black lawyers, black judges, black business people, everybody that are in powers of influence. The prime minister was black. The parliament members were black. Everybody were black people, for the most part. And so the only thing preventing me from being one of those people was poverty. My grandmother couldn't afford to send me to school to learn, to be educated, to become a lawyer, a judge, or politician. And when I came to Canada, that condition was cured. I no longer had that because education was free. I had the right to go to high school. And if I'm smart enough, I can get a scholarship to go to university. So to me, my color was never an obstacle. Just my poverty was. So when someone sent the message to me that you're not going to be here because, I filled in that because I'm a guy, because I'm dressed to fancy.
But that may not be what they meant.
But that later on, looking back, you knew that the sign was very obvious because my brothers and sisters who were born here would know exactly what that meant and would have gone, okay, I got to leave this profession because I'm not going to get anywhere.
You continued to work your way up the food chain, 5 years at Canwest. Then you moved to CIBC Mellon. You're managing white guys who are twice as old as you are. How'd that go?
I remember my, one of the guys who was managing in my mid 20s, you know, and he was 55. He's as old as I am now. And I could see how he would take exception to that. This young kid, he's been with the company for 30 years, and he now has to report to me. And so he had a problem with that. But then I put myself in his shoes. But he was just giving me the gears every single day. Every single day, he would pack up his bags and he would do it loudly so everybody would see early and would just walk out. And so I go, you know what? I need him more than he needs me. I had a job that I was really over my head. I didn't know how to do. And he's been doing that job for 30 years and I just started. So I'm gonna get him to be an ally. I have to befriend him. So him and I had a come to Jesus conversation and I just allowed him to be the boss. So when he walked into a room, automatically clients would assume that he was the boss. He was a middle-aged white man with gray hair, and I was a mid-20s black guy. Automatically, they would assume that he is the boss. So I gave them that impression, and I took notes, and he would run the meetings. And ultimately, he started to give me nuggets of knowledge. Wes, here's how you should behave in this situation. When he asked this question, here's how you should respond. And that's how I learned. You know, my ego didn't allow me to prevent myself from learning and moving ahead.
Well, at one point, you came to the conclusion, and this is a quote from the book, being black is my superpower, yep. You said. What did that mean?
It means that in a lot of cases, people underestimate you because of the color of your skin, or me anyways. And they put their guards down. They don't bring their A game. They just go, he's uneducated, he's not as smart. All the different things that come into their minds when they think about what a black person can or can't do. And so I'm in an industry whereby if you underestimate somebody, it's just like in a ring with Mike Tyson. You underestimate them, you're gonna be—
You pay for it.
You're gonna be on your back.
Yeah.
And then you're gonna find out when they put smelling salt in front of you and you get up and you go, what just happened? Well, you had your hand behind your back and you were being cocky.
But the fact that you managed to go from working in a chicken factory to, and I'm not even gonna get to where you are right now, but you moved up the food chain pretty quickly. You know, for a 20-something black kid from Jamaica, you did pretty well. To what do you attribute that success?
You know, after writing the book and then reading it, I went, how did this happen? how did this happen? Everybody goes, tell me, Wes, tell me, give me the secret to your success. I don't think I had any secrets other than the fact that I was able to exploit every single opportunity that was put in front of me. Every single one of them.
And you were ambitious.
I was ambitious, but think about, you know, when people say the chicken farm, right? You work at a chicken farm. I can't believe that. Well, that opportunity could have led me to be the general manager of the chicken farm and potentially the CEO of the company if I'm smart enough.
Right.
If I'm smart enough and I'm ambitious enough. So it doesn't really matter where you start. So I started in the mailroom. And a lot of people would go, I would never start in the mailroom. But guess what? Look where it got me. So I was able to exploit every single opportunity presented to me when others would go, I would never do that.
There is another line in your book where you say, I can tell you for a fact, black people know when it's about race. How do you know?
So I'm driving my car. I have a Ferrari 458 Spider. And I'm driving to the office. I was dressed like this without a tie on. And somebody go, stopped my car, handed me his business card and go, I'm a criminal lawyer in the city of Toronto. Give me a call if you're looking for a lawyer. Is that about race? I drive that car to the Four Seasons to have lunch with a client. I get out and somebody hand me $20 to valet their car for them. Is that about race? I go to the, I'm traveling, go to the airport, walk into the priority line. Just before I handed my boarding pass, you're in the wrong line. You need to be in the economy line. Is that about race? So a lot of people have explanations to say, maybe it's because you were dressed this way. Maybe it's because your car was too flashy. Maybe, maybe, maybe.
You forgot the best story. You're jogging in your neighborhood with your wife. Tell that story.
I'm jogging through my neighborhood and my, you know, people would say, could I use your personal trainer one day? To my wife.
They think and you're her personal trainer.
They think I'm my wife's personal trainer. Or they come to my house and go get Mr. Hall for me. Or they ask me, are you the security guard? So again, you can excuse those behavior every now and then, but all of a sudden, when they just keep on adding on and adding on and piling on and piling on, you go, it's got to be about race. I'm not that naive to think that people are that ignorant.
In which case, you start something called Black North Initiative.
Yeah.
What's that?
So after George Floyd was murdered, I wrote an article, and it was published in one of the major newspapers. And it was on the front page. And it was entitled, When I Look in the Mirror, I See George Floyd. And in the article, I talked about me experiencing the effect that his murder had on me when I watched that video. And I looked and I stood up. Everybody was working remotely at the time, virtually. I was in my home office and I stood up after watching the video. And there's a mirror in front of me and I literally saw George Floyd looking back at me. Because what I saw was how I would have been treated had I been in that situation. Nobody would care if I live in one of the fancy neighborhoods in the city, if I work on Bay Street, what my bank account balance was. They wouldn't have cared. All they saw was a black man because he was driving a Mercedes-Benz and I had one in my driveway. And nobody asked him any questions. So, but I also start to recount my experiences as a black person. And I talk about me jogging through my neighborhood and a white woman fell in front of me. And I hesitated to help her because I was scared about the potential consequences of me trying to help her. Mm. What if she was disoriented? Then she started fighting me off. My neighbors were all white because I'm the only black person in the neighborhood. And then all of a sudden the police shows up. We know the stats with respect to how police treat black people. And I have no identification because I was out jogging. I hesitated and I asked a question of my neighbors. How many of you in my position would see someone in need and hesitated because of the potential consequences to you? And so when I wrote that article, I started to get a lot of inbound calls from a lot of corporate leaders saying, Wes, I didn't get it. How can I help you? And at the end of the day, I go, let's start this organization called the Canadian Council of Business Leaders Against Anti-Black Systemic Racism. Mm. It's a mouthful. Let's call it the Black North Initiative. Mm. And because we're all CEOs, let's agree that we're going to change the conversation within our own companies. And we're going to start at the C-suite level, the board level, the C-suite level, the pipeline, and all aspect. We're going to look around and go, are there black people here? And if there aren't, why not? And what are we going
to
do about it?
Well, this must happen to you all the time. You walk into a board meeting, you're the only black face in the room. Am I
yes,
right?
Yes, it is very common. And it's still common, is common today. And but I also know that there are a ton of very smart, capable black people in this country. I meet a lot of them. And a lot of them tell me that they just can't get the breaks. They just can't get it. See, I was pretty fortunate when I came here because I was able to meet, you remember I talk about exploiting every single opportunity? But you have to meet the right people to be able to exploit those opportunities. I could have been just like that person in the mail that in saying, you'll never be a law clerk in this company. Well, that's the wrong person. But then when I got the job at Canwest, I met the right person. And that right person was able to say, I don't really care what you look like. You're smart, you're going to get the break. And so I was able to maneuver my way throughout the system to meet some wrong people, put that aside, find the right person, embrace them, embrace what they're teaching me, and then use that to get to the next level.
There are going to be people who will listen to your story, may read the book, and they will say, look where he started, look where he is now. He's a, you know, titan on Bay Street. He's got a great TV show. This story proves that Canada is not a racist country because otherwise he'd never been able to achieve what he achieved. Is that the wrong conclusion?
It is because I would say point to another.
You are pretty unique, aren't you?
It's like, there's not too many. And so if it doesn't exist, there should be so many more of me out there.
Do you feel like a unicorn?
In some circles. But I also feel that I have a privilege when I'm in those positions of being a unicorn to now educate the people who are gracious enough to allow me in the room to let them know why other people like me should be in the room as well.
Hmm. Let's finish up on this. Black North Initiative. The idea is out there. You've asked corporate, you've asked political people for support to get it going, mm-hmm. put some oomph into it. How's it going?
It's going amazing. When you look at corporate Canada today, the face of corporate Canada is very different than it was in 2020. two short years. Just look at the boards, look at the C-suite, look at the universities, the kids graduating, the kids getting jobs. Very different. However, there are some out there who believe that we haven't done enough, because their expectation is that after 400 years of oppression, that it should be solved in 2 years by this organization, Black North.
Right.
That's an offense to all the Black people who fought so hard, Martin Luther King Jr. and others, who fought so hard to advance the ball, that we're going to start this organization, Black North, and racism is going to be eradicated in Canada for good in 2 years.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe not.
I want to show the cover of this book, because that little 6-7-year-old kid from Jamaica is now worth how much?
A little bit more than that.
A little bit more than he was worth back then. I can't thank you enough for coming in here and telling your story. The book is a great read. You are astonishing.
Well, Steve, thank you.
Plain and simple. No bootstraps when you're barefoot. Wes Hall. Thank you so much, Wes.
Steve, thanks for having me.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.